Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is our election season series, What It Means to Be an American. I'm asking poets and activists, artists, writers, and more to reflect on the idea and the ideal of American identity.
Well, you're not from around here. You're probably not our kind. It's hot from March to Christmas. And other things you'll find won't fit your old ideas. They're a line of shifting sands. Walk across a ghostly bridge to a crumbling promised land.
Today, musician Roseanne Cash. As she settled into a studio in New York, where she's lived for more than 20 years, I asked her to consider Langston Hughes' challenge in his poem, Let America Be America Again. Published in 1936, Hughes writes, "Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed."
I just wrote it down so I could really think about it and examine it.
Okay.
You know, I knew I was going to talk to you about this, and I've been thinking a lot about it, and the election has exhausted me, and I've been feeling kind of dispirited about America. But this poem that you just quoted to me, Langston Hughes' poem, that's, you know, it's so full of a sense of nobility and longing for greatness and, you know, looking for our better angels, that inspires me. I mean, it makes me proud that we had a dream to begin with and gives me hope that we can keep putting it into action, you know, even at my darkest moments when I think about what John Adams said about, I mean, I've quoted this over the years so many times, that what John Adams said about democracies murdering themselves and they could never survive. And because of the election and how dark it's been, I was thinking about that. Well, you know, maybe that's happening. That could be happening. Is it going to be terrible? Are we going to, you know, segue into some kind of authoritarianism, or is it going to be wonderful? Are we going to, is the government going to rise to provide us with social services like we deserve and value the arts and value education and take care of the health of our people? And, you know, we're in flux right now, but I don't have this fantasy that it was perfect for the founders and that this perfect moment arrived of the dream where it became reality, because it was bloody and it was a mess and, you know, they were killing each other. And I think that what the founders intended was a dream, not something that actually existed and maybe still doesn't exist. Maybe in our best moments it exists in certain parts, but certainly not on a broad scale. You know, all men, they said all men are created equal, but clearly they weren't when they said that, and women weren't included at all. So I have to think about the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, all of that as being a living thing, ever-changing. You know, maybe refining the dream. I'm going to stick to what Langston Hughes thought. Maybe we're refining the dream.
Do you mentioned the Constitution, and I wonder if you think that all this tumult, the upheaval, you know, the questions that we're asking of one another, sometimes in elevated ways and sometimes not in this campaign,
right,
is kind of a resettling or a reassessing of what we the people means, and that we're seeing a certain part of America that is not comfortable with the idea of that new portrait of what we the people means.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it's scary. It's like, I mean, to put the most ugly graphic term on it, it's like a boil has been lanced and the poison is, you know, there for all of us to see. But maybe that's necessary. Maybe, you know, those dark things that have been hidden need to rise to the surface so that we can say, well, this is us and this is not us. Or, you know, I've thought that being an American requires being able to hold two opposing thoughts. You know, that I hate what you say and I defend your right to say it. I believe in revolution, a peaceful revolution, and I believe in tradition. You know, how to hold all of that at the same time. And I really think that we have lost a lot of the ability of that, and we've lost the ability to listen to each other. You know, it used to be when I was a kid, on talk shows, you would have scientists and Nobel Prize winners and people, philosophers, people of great thoughtfulness, along with entertainers to come and have, you know, that people of import, real serious thinkers were brought on nighttime talk shows. I remember that. That doesn't happen anymore. Maybe one or two, but and you know, now we're reduced to kind of a reality show culture, and instead of a vigorous dialogue in this country about what has meaning to us, and that's disheartening. I was thinking about this. I have this one guy I know, Ed, and he's a writer. He's not a professional writer, but he writes beautiful essays. I've always admired his writing. Don't know him well, but he's a Christian fundamentalist, and which is about the most polar opposite from me as you could get. And, but he has this unbelievable ability to listen to ideas that are diametrically opposed to his beliefs and talk about it respectfully. And sometimes he'll be writing a piece about something political or spiritual, and he'll write and say, I want to be sure I get the other side's point of view correctly. Is this what you think? Is this what you believe? And every time I get one of those emails from him, I well up with tears. It feels so great to be heard, you know, to have a respectful disagreement. I just don't see that much anymore. I don't see our leaders modeling it for us. I don't see it in culture. I see those things being devalued, people becoming really entrenched in their beliefs, not being able to hold two opposing thoughts. And it's sad. You know, the Cash family has been in America since the 1650s.
Wow.
And I take great pride in that. You know, my family, the Cashes, fought on both sides of the Civil War, wow, Confederate and Union. You know, the metaphor of that is so beautiful to me. I contain both those parts. You know, my DNA is seriously American. I mean, going back to Scottish times, but we've been here a long, long time. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud of my connection to the musical heritage of this country. You know, and so much about the culture that moves me so deeply. And the things that I love seem to be devalued.
You know, you mentioning that about your ancestry and the deep roots that your family has in America makes me wonder how much of, you know, the idea of the dream, the ideal of the dream is shaped by the geography, the southern geography that is really important to your family.
Yeah, that's interesting, because they settled in two parts of the country. They settled in Massachusetts and in the hills of Virginia. And I've thought about that a lot, particularly the etymology of the music that came from Appalachia in the South, you know, tracing back to Celtic music, Elizabethan music, and then in the Delta, tracing back to African music. And I think that the musical heritage shapes me, you know, as much as anything. But the geography, that's, you know, I love the resonance of geography, of particular how Memphis is a totally different feeling than Detroit, you know, and that Los Angeles is really different than Charleston, you know, and the singular things that make a place, and yeah, I do carry some of that. I always say Memphis is a movable feast. You know, I was born there, I didn't grow up there, but I took it with me when I left.
This is something that I don't know if you've read the writer and poet Ron Rash.
No, I haven't.
He writes about his family firmly rooted in Appalachia and specifically in the mountains of North Carolina. And he says, we wouldn't be the Rashes but for those mountains, but for the darkness and the shadows and the coolness that the mountains create. It's such a visceral connection to a landscape. And when I, you know, listen to the river and the thread and I see what you've been exploring recently, I feel like I'm hearing some of that too.
Oh, I hope you're hearing it, because I intend that, you know, the Civil War couple who were by the James River,
right,
in my song When the Master Calls the Roll, visceral kind of wetness and darkness of Florence, Alabama, and going to the Magic Wall there and driving through the Delta, and then the haunted quality of Money Road in Mississippi. I mean, all of those places are haunted with both good and bad.
Girl with hair of flaming red, seeking perfect lover, for to lie down on her feathered bed, solve secrets to uncover.
So broaden that and think about how American identity is rooted in the different geographies that we come from. And then I think about, so is that a barrier sometimes to what you talked about, being able to hold contradictory ideas or really hear one another? Is that another one of the barriers that is dividing this idea, an ideal of we the people?
I think so. I mean, we're vast. The country is vast, and every area is particular to itself. You know, I was just reading this article in The New Yorker yesterday about this county in West Virginia, and this man, he said the most interesting thing. She quoted this guy who said he was from West Virginia, but he had lived in California, and he was afraid all of the time because the spaces were so open. And he got back to the hills and mountains and hollers of West Virginia, and he felt safe, as if the mountains were hugging him and holding him close. I thought, well, wow, that has to exist in so many people. You know, the people who live in the plains, the open spaces of that, the fields and farms, that must be part of their psyche. It must be part of the prism which they look through to view the rest of the world. And maybe, yeah, it goes into territoriality. Like, this is who I am. I am part of this, and you're not. And I need to preserve this, and I need to protect myself from you. Don't bring your vast open spaces into my cozy mountains.
Exactly. You know, I have this sense that that even though the American identity is about looking forward in the idea that we are unfinished, I think that's some of where the optimism, you know, we're a relatively young country, and we embrace this idea of being unfinished. And, but the, but the, puzzling thing to me about this is that there is also this strong sense of nostalgia when we think about in this campaign, but also when we think about what the ideal is. There's two contradictory ideas that are puzzling. Maybe you have some wisdom on that.
I don't think I have any wisdom, but when you were just talking, I was thinking, the Cash family was here 120 something years before the revolution, and they were mariners, and they gave up, William Cash gave up a lifetime of sailing the ocean to move to Salem, Massachusetts, and then his nephew came and went down south, and that's my direct line. But he gave up something huge because of a dream and an ideal like you're talking about. And I keep thinking about the longing, the longing for something to identify yourself with that's bigger and bolder and more free than we are as individuals. And I mean, when I just think about that for myself, it moves me so much. I don't think that dream is dead or over, but I think it's in flux. I think it's being redefined. And, in the campaign, talking about how we used to be and idealizing the past, I don't think that serves us at all. I mean, that's why I call myself a progressive. But because, there's a lot of bad things in the past, too.
I've wondered why, and it sounds like you've given some thought to this, about why that nostalgia is such a comforting and powerful thing. And in our political process, it seems that we want to come back to that every, couple of decades, I guess.
What's that word? Is there a German word for longing for a place you've never been?
Mm.
I think maybe sometimes we get consumed by that. This ideal. I mean, when there's a lot of pain in your life, maybe you do dream that there's some perfect place or perfect way to be, or that your parents, had it so much better. I don't know. I think it's partly what you just said about us being a young country. I mean, as far as countries go, we are in adolescence and still trying to find ourselves and trying to figure out who we are and what we believe in, what we want. Like people say, I don't want the government to take my rights away from me. Why aren't the schools better and the roads fixed, I want the government out of my life, yet a woman should have no right over her reproductive life. I don't get it. I mean, those two contradictory thoughts kind of cancel each other out.
I wanted you to, I listened back to a speech that President Obama gave in Selma earlier this year, in which he, in a really beautiful way, articulated a lot of the contradictions that we've been talking about this morning, but also this ideal of what it means to be an American. And I've pulled out this bit where he talks about American exceptionalism. So listen to this, and then let's talk about what we hear. Here's President Obama.
For we were born of change. We broke the old aristocracies, declaring ourselves entitled not by bloodline, but endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. We secure our rights and responsibilities through a system of self-government, of and by and for the people. That's why we argue and fight with so much passion and conviction, because we know our efforts matter. We know America is what we make of it.
What does that say to you?
It says I'm not half as articulate as President Obama.
He has speech writers, don't forget.
Oh my God, I just get goosebumps hearing that. He's so passionate. Born of change. What a beautiful way to put it. I recoil slightly at the idea of American exceptionalism. Because there's, manifest destiny wasn't such a great thing. And It seems to carry the baggage of arrogance and imperialism with it. But the way he put it, it is exceptional that we were born of change and that we decided on a system of self-government, you know, that we could do this. We had confidence in ourselves that we could do it. Well, maybe sometimes we can, maybe sometimes we can't. I have to think of it in terms of relationships that, you know, how if you're in a long romantic relationship, you, in the beginning, you're just flush with romance and love, and you're just blinded by the idea that this is the greatest thing in the world and you have something better than everybody else and so in love with this other person. And then in the middle years, if you stick with it, you're annoyed with this person. You can't believe you decided to be with this person. And, you know, he's just grates on you terribly and you don't listen to each other and you're in a power struggle. And then if you get through that to true love, you know, just acceptance, I can listen to you. You're so different from me, but I really accept you. You know, let's build something great together by combining our differences with respect. That's what I hope for.
I wonder if the idea of American exceptionalism, which, as you said, makes you a little queasy, you know, gets in the way of a necessity to be more self-critical. That it's an easy go-to. We might have our problems, but we are the greatest country. Look, everybody says that. President Obama said that during the campaign, and that it lets us blind ourselves to the flaws and the necessity of solving the flaws. What do you think?
I think you're right. And I think that kind of belief in like a default position of exceptionalism so that we don't have to change or, you know, strive to be better is like fundamentalism. It's like, I'm right. My beliefs are totally right. No argument. Nobody else should believe any way else. Well, that doesn't really lead anywhere. And I think it's dangerous. I mean, again, like going back to the relationship metaphor, if you don't allow yourself to change in service of the partnership, then you're going to break up.
It scares me to think, as we mentioned a minute ago, that we are only in the adolescence of we are adolescents trying to come together in a mature relationship. You know, age-wise, right? That is kind of where we are.
That's right. I mean, but you look at even the UK, a constitutional monarchy that's been going on for a very long time, a lot longer than us. And they're in the biggest crisis of their existence.
Oh, that's right.
So, you know, maybe they're having a midlife crisis.
Do you think mythology is an important element of figuring out what an identity, the American identity, what a national identity is?
I never thought about that. That's interesting. You know, I loved the work of Joseph Campbell and the way he presented all the myths of the world and the hero's journeys and the symbolism and this way that was just so accepting and fascinated with what every culture had to bring. And, you know, maybe the story of the hero's journey is something to apply to the American dream and see if it fits. Like, where are we going? I mean, I wonder if that's true that countries have their own hero's journey, and some that don't end well and some that do.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, the impulse to do something great, the journey, the martyrdom, the enlightenment, transformation, all those pieces of it. Maybe right now we're in the martyrdom phase.
Is that what you think?
Well, it's been, you know, I have to get away from the election to get my bearings again because it's been so dark and unsettling that I've, like I said, I've been really dispirited about what's happening to America and where we might be going and if it will break apart at the seams. And is that necessary? You know, how in physics they say that that a structure has to fall apart before it can be rebuilt at a higher level. So maybe that's what's happening, but we just hope it's a higher level or a better level.
I think that's the anxiety, right? That is there anything that could possibly be good that will come from the destructiveness? And I don't mean that we're tearing it all down. I don't think that's what's going on, but this has felt destructive. And what if there isn't something good on the other side of it?
Yeah, there might not be. I mean, John Adams, again, said that all democracies will self-destruct. But the dream that we were talking about is so essential to our self-identity that maybe that's what will get us to the other side. And maybe the fact that all of this poison is really out in the open and we can all see it, maybe that is also essential. So we can say, that's not us, this is us. And I mean, I think you do have to see the opposite of what defines you, either to discard it or to recommit.
You saying that about the dream reminded me of one of the conversations that I've had in the series is with Julissa Arce. She's an activist, a young woman who her parents brought her to the United States on a visa from Mexico, and then that visa expired when she was 14, and she became an undocumented immigrant at that point. And went through all of the shame and, you know, having to hold that secret, even as she graduated near the top of her class in high school and went on to college and went on to work on Wall Street. But one of the things that she says she's never forgotten in that experience of being undocumented was having to assess constantly the value of what it means to be part of this idea of America, and looking around and realizing, as most of us have the luxury of doing, that we don't think about it very often.
Do you have all these people that say, well, I'm American because I was born here, and yet, like, in their everyday life, they're not thinking every day, what am I doing to earn being an American? And that's why when you were saying entitled, you know, that word to me is like, I tend to think of, like, you know, like those people who, like, they do feel entitled to everything just because they were born here. And I think that's just lucky. Like, you know, nobody chooses where they are born. Nobody chooses what kind of situation they are born into. That's just the draw of the luck. Like, that's just, you're blessed. You're blessed to have been born in this country. So, like, what are you doing to be worthy of it?
Wow, that's powerful. And, yeah, we do take it for granted. And the truth is, if you're not Native American, you're an immigrant. And, you know, I have to put myself in her shoes and see how that would feel. And the longing, again, the longing that would define my everyday existence. And sadness, too. Like, you know, the community you want so badly to be part of, and you're not recognized. Maybe we all need to feel a little of that to appreciate what it is.
You know, you made me, when you talked about how long your family, your ancestors have been in the United States, pre-revolution, how many years before the revolution?
About 120.
Wow. How do you know so much about those stories? I don't know that much about my family's. Is this just something that the Cash family does?
Oh, we're so well documented, and we're all interested in it. And we have it back to the 11th century in Scotland.
Wow.
Wow. And my dad was fascinated with it. He had, you know, our ancestry bound so we could all read it. And it's just, we're proud of it. And the fact that we've been in America so long is a great source of pride, too. And like I said, the first cache, he gave up his entire way of life and the thing he loved most to be part of this dream of a new country. I feel that the history of this country is part of my DNA, and it makes me proud, and it also makes me humble. Like, I've been part of a dream from the beginning, and, you know, it feels nightmarish right now sometimes, but that's only because I wasn't around when other nightmares happen, and we got through that. And I'm an optimist. I think we'll get through this. We may have to dismantle part of ourselves to put ourselves back together, but that may be okay.
When you look at photographs, you know, this is when I was when I was having this conversation with Julissa about the journey, the path that they took. She'll tell that story someday to her kids, and her kids will tell, you know, and that will become the kind of story in a way that has lived on through your generations of your family.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about someday her great-great-great-grandkids will study photographs of Julissa and look for what the determination and the resilience that led her to do what she did. And it's something that I look for in the old photographs in my family, and I wonder if it's something you do too with these caches that go way back.
Oh, yes, so much. I mean, the caches in Arkansas were so tenacious. My grandmother, who raised seven children without electricity for many years, who picked cotton, you know, gave birth in their little house out in the field. She had such spirit and tenacity. So I look at pictures of her and think, what survives in me of her? What do I have that's her? And then I have this distant cousin, Wayne Cash, who's a historian of the Cash family, and he sends me regular pieces he finds of newspaper clippings back to the late 19th century, with pictures and stories, and the Cash who was the sheriff who got killed, and the Cash who, you know, whose fiance died in the Civil War. And all of these stories make up who I am, too. I mean, and that's part of what the river and the thread is, too, is the what survives of those places and those people in me, and what am I giving to the future of what survived. And it's incredibly important to me. And, you know, I feel that we were there at the inception and of America. And it's a great source of pride. And it definitely is part of how I see the world. It makes me feel stronger and better about myself that we took part in this dream and we're still part of creating it.
Five cans of paint in the empty fields, the dust reveals the chill.
I read what you said about Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize for Literature, and it seemed like you were saying in the Washington Post that it was high time that songwriting was equated with literature, especially the kind of literature that Bob Dylan brings us. I was hoping you'd say more about that.
Yeah, you know, I write prose as well as songs, and I can't tell you how many times people have said to me when they found I wrote prose, you're a real writer. As if songwriting was a poor cousin to real writing and didn't take the same discipline. And, you know, it just, it's so offensive to me. So I felt that we were, songwriters were vindicated in that way when Bob won. But also, like I said, you know, all our boats rose. All the boats of all songwriters rose with that moment, with him winning the Nobel Prize. I was talking to John about it, my husband, and I said, you know, this may never, ever happen again. They may never give it to another songwriter, but it now exists. It's done. We can all point to that. You know, those Bob Dylan, those professors who teach courses on Bob Dylan in university are vindicated.
You're listening to our election season series, What It Means to Be an American. And I'm talking with writer, musician, artist Roseanne Cash. Before we heard the news about Dylan winning the prize, I was interviewing the writer and poet Luis Urrea for this series on what it means to be an American. And given what you said about Dylan and the prize to the Post, I wanted you to hear what Luis said when I asked him about musicians who say something about America to him. So listen to this.
I can tell you the song that made me understand how impossibly powerful both, I think, language and message, because it was a song about utter frustration and prophecy, and that was, "It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding." You know, by the time I got certainly to junior high school and the ruptures became evident to me in my own being, I was being called greaser and wetback and taco bender and all these things. And my family was being disparaged, and what I thought had been my culture was being disparaged. I felt this world sorrow and this feeling of being trapped. And that song spoke to that because it was this explosion of intelligence and verbiage and rhyme and outrage and resignation.
That's pretty beautiful, isn't it?
It's gorgeous. You know, I would say those songs that have that real sense of time and place of being so profoundly American in essence, they are life-changing for me, too. They mean, they have so much meaning, like, you know, Bruce Springsteen's entire album of Nebraska and what it evokes and the people, the places. It's nothing like it could exist anywhere else. And it's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding. Yeah.
And though the rules of the road have been lodged, it's only people's games that you got to dodge. And it's all right, Ma, I can make it.
I love those writers who are quintessentially American. Like, you know, you're not going to get Faulkner from any place else. Eudora Welty, Springsteen, Dylan.
I want to ask you what that essentially American sound sounds like to you.
Well, to me, it sounds like Appalachian music, the blues, and a little jazz thrown in. Those things that are quintessentially us. That have affected the entire world. You know, whenever I tour in Europe, they're just absolutely hungry for the authenticity of American music. They, I mean, not to say that Celtic music isn't authentic or any other kind of, you know, indigenous music, but they, it's so exotic to them and they appreciate it so much. And it just fills me with pride. I did this country music festival in Poland, in the middle of Poland, like, you know, 3 hours from Warsaw, if you can imagine. And I got there and it was like Howlin' Wolf or Robert Johnson or Charlie Patton had arrived when they saw me. And I was going, what is this about? And someone said to me, to them, you're the real deal. You're like, in the same way that Robert Johnson is to me, mm-hmm. I am to those people who love American country music. Whoa, this is a heavy mantle.
I was
going to
say, no pressure.
So they're seeking
through this kind of the understanding of who we are through your music? I mean, what did you conclude about that?
They touch the dream.
Okay.
They sense the dream, you know, and the geography that goes with the dream and the suffering. Oh my God, the suffering. Just, you know, you look at the Delta blues and an entire musical art form came from suffering, and there's so much beauty in it. And that's one of the functions of art, isn't it? And music, to express that for us so that we don't have to go crazy and work it out in our lives, but that the music, that there's a place for this, that the music to express. I mean, and that's one of my problems with what's going on in America, is it's been so devalued. You know, there's not even music programs in public schools anymore. That was a tangent. Sorry.
No, I don't want you to stop, though, with what you started to say, which is something I don't think I've ever asked you about, which is that I think you were saying we can experience some of our suffering through music so that we don't have to bring it, saturate ourselves so with it day to day.
Yeah. So I went to this show in Paris once. It was an art show. And it was at the Grand Palais, and it was called Melancholie. And it was 800 years of death, madness, despair, and suffering in visual art. Now, say that to some people, and they go, oh, my God, that sounds like the worst thing ever. Why would you go to that? It was the most liberating thing I've ever seen.
Wow.
It was fantastic. And you just, because we all have these corners in our psyche, we all have this, you know, everybody you see suffers, there's something there. And it was all out on the canvas, and it was so thrilling and liberating. And the essential function of art, you know, to express our own lives, to for us to see right in front of us, to put the suffering out there so that we don't have to daily let it destroy us, that doesn't get valued enough and or even recognized. And as far as blues music, you know, it's intrinsic to it. Blues music wouldn't exist without that suffering, and look what came from it, you know. Look at all the music that evolved out of that. And it's interesting to me that that is quintessentially American, that the suffering represented by the blues.
I know.
I got stones in my pathway, and my road seem dark at night. I got stones in my pathway, and my road seem dark at night. Pains in my heart, they have taken my appetite.
I did this show at Dockery Farms in Mississippi. The Dockery Farms was one of the great cotton farms in the, you know, turn of the 20th century and up through the 30s, 40s. And Howlin' Wolf and Charlie Patton and Pop Staples and all of these great blues musicians actually worked the farm and lived there. Mm-hmm. And played blues, played music after they would pick cotton in the fields. So my friend is part of the foundation that owns Dockery Farms, and they wanted to bring music back to the farm for the first time, you know, in decades and decades. So they invited me and John and the band to go play there. And we did, and it was like playing in a haunted place. It was so powerful. And at the after party, after the show, there was a 90-year-old blues harp player as the party music. Mm. So all of these people, mostly white people, mostly wealthy white people, milling around, talking at the party and having drinks. And this 90-year-old blues musician with another musician was performing kind of to the side. And I kept looking at him through the party. And at the end of the party, I went over to him and to speak to him and thank him. And I felt kind of embarrassed, you know. And he said, when I was pushing the plow in the field, when I was behind the mule, you know, back in the 50s, we had a little radio on the porch. And when your daddy came on the radio, we would all run out of the fields and gather around the radio to listen to him. And when he said that, I thought of my grandfather, who just over the Mississippi River in Arkansas was doing the same thing in the fields. And my grandfather was, you know, he was a racist. And for some reason, when that old man said it to me, Cadillac John Noten is his name, I was flooded with this sense of humility, and that part of what I was doing was breaking the chain of hatred that had existed back, you know, in my family. But that also I was borrowing from a tradition that he invented, he and his peers invented. And I felt so humbled by that. And there was such beauty in that moment for me, and a revelation and a humility which hasn't left me. And that's the power of music to me, is to be able to heal the past, to heal seemingly entrenched divisions between people.
You feed my milk cow, mama. Somebody please along. Say you see my milk mama.
Sounds, you know, maybe it sounds naive, but I think that if there was more value placed on art and music in America, that we could see ourselves better and we could heal ourselves better.
I don't know why you feel like you have to apologize for holding that view. You say that almost with a certain amount of, you know, embarrassment or something. Why?
Yeah, I guess because of the devaluing. You know, I mean, I've heard people say, politicians say, artists should get a real job. I mean, that's, I said, I'd like to see you keep my schedule for 1 month. But also, I mean, just economically, we've been devalued. You know, big tech, we're a loss leader for big tech. They've built their businesses on the backs of musicians. I mean, I don't want to go down that tunnel too far, but I'm not going to apologize anymore. You're right. If I sounded apologetic, it's because of economic uncertainty in the digital landscape and because of people who say artists should get a real job.
That's not how I'm going to end our interview. And by the way, Roseanne, get a real job.
Yeah.
Here's the way I would like to close the interview. Will you choose a song from your own catalog that speaks to some of the themes that that we've been talking about today?
Yeah, I'd choose A Feather's Not a Bird, because you know, so much of the music that I love, that's real American music, roots music, Appalachian and the blues, is about travel, about leaving home, looking for home, searching and longing. And A Feather's Not a Bird has that journey at the center of it, the search, the urgency, the longing. And yet the touchstones are the geography, the southern geography, that to me is so visceral and so beautiful and dark and haunted and full of light and, you know, contains that longing. So that's the song I choose.
I'm going down to Florence, gonna wear a pretty dress. I'll sit atop the magic wall with the voices in my head. Then we'll drive on through to Memphis, past the strongest show.
You musician, singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash, launching our series on what it means to be an American. Tomorrow, Mexican-American writer Luis Urrea. Later in the series, poet Claudia Rankine, theologian Eddie Gloud.
Pretty baby, sitting right there on my lap. They declared me unfit to live, said into that great void my soul be hurled. You want to know why I did what I did? Well, sir, I guess it's just a meanness in this world.